But we think that every presentation of every disease is unique, and nothing is further from the truth than stroke, for example, where it's like, well, okay, fair enough. There's a lot of variation in stroke presentation, but how we treat it in the United States is pretty cookbook, right? And you see that in the variance of length of stay for stroke because we've got that down. Why not other things, right?
Welcome to the Better Care Podcast, where we bring clinicians, innovators to talk about current challenges in healthcare and highlight some of the great work that folks are doing around the country. Today, I have with me Dr. Aaron Daly. Aaron is one of the chief medical officers for Riverside Health System, has interest in quality and patient safety. Yep. So, Aaron, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, looking forward to the conversation. So, tell us a little bit about your role at Riverside Health System and your interest in patient quality and safety space and how you got sort of interested in that area.
Sometimes I wonder what I do at Riverside Health System because it's a fun place to be. And, you know, you walk away after the day and like, what, I get paid to do this. So this is really good. But I wear a lot of hats there. I'm the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Riverside Health and recently the Chief Medical Officer for one of our psychiatric hospital, our only psychiatric hospital. And I'm Associate Vice President where I sit most neatly with our AI governance and future applications section. And as far as patient safety in general, I think I've worked a lot of careers in my life. Almost all of them are in the high reliability space. And whether it was nuclear power, submarine duty, aviation a little bit, and then healthcare. So if you can imagine, all those high reliability organizations deal with safety and sort of combating normal accident theory and how we can use data in those approaches. So that's sort of where it started.
Yeah. When you look at the landscape of hospital medicine, what are some of the problems that you see are hardest to move the needle on?
I think one of the biggest issues right now is certainly the moving of the goalposts from regulatory standpoint, but, you know, from stuff that we can fix. I think one of the bigger challenges is how do we, especially in a high reliability organization, eliminate variance from practice in an environment where doing that is sort of anathema to a physician, because when you wear both of those hats, I'm a neurologist by trade. And so if I have an administrator telling me how to run a stroke code, I might lose it after the stroke code.
Yeah.
But there shouldn't be a lot of variance in that. There's a well-defined script. And so that sort of dynamic can be stressful unless you bring data to the picture. And so I think that's one of the bigger challenges is how do we get that so that we can approach those conversations with data and what the best approach is from like clinical practice guidelines from your society, for example, and those marriage of those two.
When you talk about that variance, you know, and obviously, you know, sometimes you could look at a patient with the same diagnosis treated by two different doctors and we see widely different practice patterns. Yeah. Where do you think some of that comes from?
Well, I think there's some, you know, answers that I think everybody knows, right? It's, you know, depending on where you trained, depending on when you trained, depending on who trained you, even if it was at the same facility, you know, I think you're going to get some variance in that. I do think the evidence operates at a faster pace than sometimes we create providers as well. And so it's incumbent, obviously, to do your CME and whatnot. But in the continuing rat race sometimes of doing clinical medicine, I'm going to pick the CME that's interesting to me. And so it may not be the CME that we need as an organization. And so I think that's part of it. But I think, and we're stumbling across this more and more, it's not even just how the provider is providing the care. It is variance in what an acute care hospitalization is used for, in the sense that I could have a provider say, well, I want to take care of this entire spectrum of disease that this patient might have in this hospitalization. And I have a provider who would say, I don't need to do all that. I just need to do what can only be done in the acute care hospital setting.
Yeah.
And so operationally, that's an interesting question, mm-hmm. because it's not just the traditional variance on the practice of medicine. It's more so what needs to be done in an acute care setting, which is the most expensive place to do healthcare in the United States, mm-hmm. versus what can be done somewhere else in the ambulatory setting or in a virtual setting, et cetera. And so I think we're kind of stumbling upon that now, and trying to figure out how that fits.
Yeah. Where's the right balance of addressing the acute issue that requires hospitalization versus solving all of that patient's health challenges, which may be a more difficult to address all of them?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is where I think wearing both hats is nice, because I'm not decoupled from that from a provider standpoint, right? How many times has a provider come in and said, hey, you know, I'm going to say grandma, and I'm not using that pejoratively, but grandma's here, right? She had an MRI scheduled as an outpatient next week, but she's already here. So why not just get this MRI done as an out, you know, while she's here? And so that's a good patient experience thing, right? The problem with that, obviously, is that MRI, whether it needed to be done at all, is now non-reimbursable. And that might still be the right answer. And we don't want to dictate how people are going to practice necessarily. But if it's becoming a variance where one provider does that as a matter of convenience, that's great. But I'm also, as an administrator, putting that hat on, I'm not facing the family.
Yeah.
And saying, nope, sorry, we can't do that. And they don't understand that. And I promise you, if you approach them with the, well, we won't get paid for that MRI, that's a non-starter. And I think that speaks to a bigger problem in the United States. But, you know, that's not a problem that we're going to solve in this room.
Yeah. I have sort of a holy grail question for you. Sorry to throw you on the spot here. But how do you think about balancing those different variables of quality, safety, patient experience, but then cost?
Yeah.
And bringing all those factors into the equation, because obviously as a health system that may be running on razor sharp margins, yeah. and you can't just think about that patient. You have to think about the whole patient population that you have to manage and care for. How do you balance those variables?
Well, and I think you answered the question, right? I remember being in medical school, and it was an emergency physician who came in and taught us this, by the way. And they said, everything you're going to do in medicine should have evidence behind what you're doing. And from my nuclear power brain, I'm like, well, of course, that makes perfect sense, right? Like, if you're going to operate a nuclear power plant, you should know what you're doing. And there's oodles and oodles of cases where people did that poorly. Not in the Navy. I just want to throw that out there. Not in our Navy anyway. So that made sense. But then, you know, you get to the actual practice of medicine and you realize that evidence-based medicine is not treating the patient who's literally sitting right in front of you. It's treating a population of patients. And so what you're faced with as a provider at that point is, well, at least I know where I'm going to start. And that should be the step off point. And I'm not going to go towards this notion of, well, you know, I saw this once in residency, so it could be that. So let me go spend, you know, $9,000 on this genetic test when your differential diagnosis is pointing towards something else. But it could be that, right?
Yeah.
You know, we use this care gauge tool, for example, and we sort of backed into this because I don't recall it being something that was like a use case. I'm sure people are using it for this, but I don't recall it being told to us. We kind of backed our way into it of, hey, I'm going to use a DRG for stroke, for example. Mm-hmm. And then I've got a population of physicians who always want to order an MRI for a stroke. And then I've got a population of physicians who don't. Where's the difference? And so what we ended up thinking is, hey, let's at least look at the evidence base behind use of MRI for stroke, which, by the way, the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association says there's very limited use for that. Moreover, there's hardly any use for it in an acute care setting. Mm-hmm. But then why are we doing it? And so what we ended up doing was using that tool as sort of a step off point for a grand rounds, for example. It says, hey, let's review the guidelines. I'm not telling you how to practice medicine, but this is the current state of affairs because those guidelines change frequently. And if you're not keeping up with it because you choose not to, but you're maintaining your CME, who's going to direct that? So it's incumbent upon us to kind of direct the course of that, because You're not getting better quality care by spending more money on an MRI. It's just not happening. Mm-hmm. And I think with some rigor attached to it, you can look at your quality data and prove that. And there's probably some use cases where you are getting better quality care for spending more money. Then by all means, spend more money. That's not what we're getting at. We're getting at, to your point, the cost containment of unnecessary cost. So,
and I think I love that example that you highlighted, because it's saying, okay, now that we have the data and we can show that to the group and we can show them how they compare across the group, but then also now marry that up with the evidence-based guidelines so that it's an educational opportunity for everybody. And also the forum for group discussion, and, you know, helping the whole group kind of talk about the best practice that the facility wants to go forward with.
Yeah, and I think we've seen some success in that. And it's not that I'm going to convert every provider over, right? There's going to be some holdouts, and, you know, and I think you got to, as a chief medical officer specifically, sort of wonder, is that juice worth the squeeze, right? Yeah. Like, as long as what they're ordering isn't harmful to the patient, that falls into the sort of whether it's acceptable clinical variance or not. But if you can convert most of the people and say, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. And you know, we even go one further and say, look, I'm talking about the acute care setting right now. I'm not saying that this patient may not benefit from this study, but do we need to do it in the most expensive place in the enterprise?
Yeah.
You know, when folks are worried about medical legal stuff, sometimes letting them know it's going to get done. It's just doesn't need to be done here, because then you can approach that from an ethical standpoint and say, hey, from a distributive justice standpoint, I need these beds,
yeah,
right? I need the resource. The resource is constrained, but it's less constrained, you know, 20 miles down the road. And I think that helps me sleep better at night, because there is a counter to this. Obviously, it's like, well, you're saying you're going to displace that care onto the outpatient setting where it's fee for service. Why not just do it in the hospital? I didn't set up the rules, right? Like, you know, the insurance companies set up these rules. And so the point is it necessary in the acute care hospital so then I can use those beds for the people who need them?
Yeah. And every physician wants to take the best care of every individual patient, but at the same time, they also have that lens on resource utilization across the hospital, throughput. Hey, if every one of my patients is staying for 3 days longer than they should be, now I'm exposing them to iatrogenic risks of that hospitalization,
sure,
being in a hospital setting. So it's always that balance of delivering the highest quality care with the most efficiency that decreases iatrogenic risk and also allows for resource availability for those patients who need it the most.
I couldn't agree more. I would also say that, and this is my opinion now, but I think it's evident in the burgeoning cost of care, aside from the what I would call the friction of healthcare, which is the middle of arguing about who's going to pay for this. I'm not going to pay for this. You need to pay for this. I gave you the case to pay, like all of that. I think Eric Wexler spoke at Becker's last fall and said it so eloquently. There's no way I'm going to say it more eloquently than him. He's the CEO of Providence Health, right? But he basically said, if you eliminate all that friction in healthcare, that's $2.5 trillion or something that we could put back and actually return to the patients who are paying these exorbitant fees, right? Mm-hmm. I might have the numbers wrong, so I apologize if Eric Wexler's watching, but I think the point is still the same, right? But what we can control in our sphere of influence is that cost in both the acute care and ambulatory setting. And if we can attach data to it and let folks know that when they go home at night, they've taken the best care of the patient that they can, and they didn't have to worry about the cost, that becomes that culture shift from looking at this in the acute care setting.
Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit here. Mm-hmm. So talking about length of stay, obviously it's a big topic.
Yeah.
Throughput contributes to cost,
yeah,
contributes to resource utilization, but it also increases harm potentially to the patient if they're staying longer in the hospital than they should.
Yeah.
Length of stay is obviously an issue every health system is looking at. What are some of the sort of under the hood areas that contribute to length of stay variance in your experience?
Yeah, I look at this very operationally I spent the majority of my time in the military in the operations world. And so I think of things that way. I was having a discussion with a professor at Christopher Newport University, which is across the street from our hospital. And I want to preface this by saying patients are not widgets, right? I get that. We're not manufacturing patients or anything like that. But I was
moving
trying
to down an assembly line.
Right, right. Like, and to say that is sort of even belittles the work that we do, because this is more important than manufacturing. However, if you're going to conceptually frame a hospital as a manufacturing plant, you're wrong. And I thought I had this in my head. I had it down pat. And I was like, okay, so if I just get the processes right and the sequencing of the processes and make sure, you know, I'm using the constrained resources in the right way. And if you've ever read The Goal, that gets like shoved in your head and during MBA school. And I was like, I've got it down pat. The problem is, and this professor like blew my mind in 4 seconds, because you know, he's way smarter than me in business for sure. He's like, it's not a manufacturing plant, Aaron. It's like, okay, but it is. He goes, it's a refurbishing plant. I was like, whoa, okay. But he's right. And his point was, if you're a company that does like warranty work, you have no idea what you are going to get when the customer sends that product back. And I'm like, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Because, you know, from an emergency physician standpoint, like, well, yeah, I have no idea what I'm going to get. I know what the board says, but I even walk in the room and it's hardly ever what the board says, right? Yep. And so you're trying to troubleshoot through that. You're trying to figure out, all right, what is going on? But make no mistake, like I did electronic troubleshooting for 10 years in the Navy, right? There were weird things that would happen, but the vast majority of them fit very discernible patterns. We had very explicit ways that we troubleshooted things. And so medicine can still fit that mold despite the variance in the patient presentation. It's the weirdness that happens, and I'm going to say that as politely as I can, where it's like, well, this doesn't really fit a lot of picture. That's where there's going to be a lot of variation. We should be willing to accept that, right? Where there's not, though, we should be able to have pretty standard protocols while maintaining autonomy of the provider, certainly maintaining the autonomy of the patient. And that should lower the length of stay variance quite a bit. But I don't think we think about it that way. We think that every patient, and they're unique. I'm not saying that. But we think that every presentation of every disease is unique, and nothing is further from the truth in stroke, for example, where it's like, well, okay, fair enough. There's a lot of variation in stroke presentation, but how we treat it in the United States is pretty cookbook, right? And you see that in the variance of length of stay for stroke, because we've got that down. Why not other things, right? The other point I would point out is when you're talking about constrained resources, that can literally ruin your day. And if you want to go back to the book, The Goal, which if anybody's ever read it, it is like a quintessential foundational MBA operations book, right? If you're trying to get a product out, and again, patients aren't products, but if you're trying to do that in a certain period of time and you've got a bottlenecked resource and you need that resource on that product, you got a problem. Well, the way to unbottleneck it is not to utilize that resource if it's not absolutely necessary. And so from this one professor, and I wish I remembered his name, I have his card, and if I find out, I'll let you know, because he's brilliant, and I'm trying to give credit where credit's due. He's like, no, it's a refurbishing plant. And so you don't even know what resources you're going to need. Mm-hmm. But if you overutilize them, you know it's going to take forever. And so when we're looking at that, and now we've got this tool, CareGauge, that helps us with that, it's like, hey, these pathways need to be fine-tuned.
Yeah, so you almost need to become good at those repeatable patterns, become really good at those, because you need know that there's going to be some that are outliers, and you're going to have to accept that those are going to be outliers.
Yeah, and from a pure statistical standpoint, you know, it's probably still going to follow a natural distribution, but the standard deviation is going to be really, really tight. So it looks like, hey, you know, 2 standard deviations from the mean on either side, if that's 0.1 day, you're doing pretty good. That's a tight process. In fact, I would argue from a quality and safety standpoint, that may be a little too tight. And that's why we always had that countermeasure to length of stay, which is, you know, readmission rate. And you're looking at it in a standardized way from observed to expected. And so I do think that, you know, from a pure CMO perspective, it's not as oversimplified as I'm saying. But when you're designing the system, you need to take that into consideration. Hey, what are our surveillance or countermeasures that we're using to make sure we're not doing things way too standard? Because, you know, again, let's face it, patients aren't standard.
Do you think physicians are open to and amenable to having access to the data? And where I'm going with this is, for so long, payers had all the data. Even still, they probably have better analytics than the health systems do, or the health systems have the data, or we start to give doctors data, but it's based off of claims data, which is inaccurate.
Yeah.
But now we're moving to this point where the doctors are having more data accessibility and transparency, you know, within their workflow. Do you think they're open to it? Do you think that they're ready for it?
Yes and no, right? People can make sort of broad inferences from, you know, well, I know a provider is not going to do that no matter what you do, right? Mm-hmm. And you can build a prototype of what that provider looks like in your head. I'm fine with that. You know, I'm not going to chase the dream, as it were, right? I think, and we were very deliberate when we rolled out CareGage about selecting who our champions were. And we wanted a contrary opinion on that team, for sure. But we really wanted likely adopters on that team. And it's not, I don't think it's secret sauce to figure out that folks who are probably closer to their residency, maybe more tech forward, are folks that will appreciate this. But make no mistake, I mean, there are folks, particularly our lead hospitalist, who I thought was going to be, man, we don't need this. He's a data-driven person. And he was somebody I thought would probably be not as on board, and he was the lead. So that was a risk, right? But he said this works perfectly with their workflow because he's trying to, in a way, eliminate that variance because, frankly, I think a lot of health systems do this. They incent their hospitalists based on, you know, length of stay. You got to be super careful how you do that, right? Because you can incent me on length of stay. I'm going to try and, you know, get this patient out of here today. And that's kind of the point of, you also have that countermeasure of readmission rate. And so he looks at it from the standpoint of, well, look at your data of what you do for this particular diagnosis, and your length of stay is much, much higher for those patients than your peer group. And then just sits back and lets that percolate. Mm-hmm. Because people will make that connection. How do I change? And I think that's the value and the power of knowing what your peer group is doing, right? And it's like, okay, well, let me go ask, you know, Mary why she's really good at this, and maybe I can improve that way. And so some of that's grassroots. I mean, we can approach it from a grand rounds perspective. We can approach it from all sorts of, you know, top-down perspectives. But that value from the grassroots perspective is difficult to put a number on, but it happens.
Yeah. When you're bringing data back to the physicians, and in some cases even sharing it unblinded so they can see how they compare with their peers, how do you think about bringing that to them in a way that doesn't feel like you're weaponizing the data, that makes them feel like this is a collaborative conversation so that we can all get better, and not have those doctors think, you know, oh, they're just going to use this against us?
So part of that is messaging. I mean, just being frank, you know, Tom and me, Tom's our chief medical officer for the system. We're very deliberate about our messaging and saying, this is for your information. We are not incenting you. We're not disincenting you. We're not, you know, evaluating you based on this. But I'm sure anybody who's worked in any health system knows that sometimes that's what is said, but what actually happens is something different, right? And so, you know, the other challenge that we have is making sure that that's not happening, right? Because we can say that, and I will hold true to that because I'm a person of integrity, but I don't know what's necessarily going on in that service line. And so making sure that we know that that service line is using the data for good as well, because there is a risk to unblinding that. And even shaming, potentially. It's like, we all know the patient and we all know the provider who's going to order everything under the sun. We already know that provider, right? This just puts sort of attachment to it, and then it's not plausible deniability anymore, right? So I think you can end up shaming people if you're not careful. So how do you combat that? By giving them something that they've actually wanted, which is access to cost data. We're pretty careful about how we tell them that that cost data is derived, because I think they need to know the why. And we're also extremely careful to tell them, don't go and tell a patient that this is the cost, because you lose credibility pretty quickly when you're talking about variable cost and not total cost.
Yeah.
When the media will say, you know, this is an MRI cost $5,000 and you're just doing the marginal sort of cost, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, frankly, a lot of providers don't know that, right? They don't, we were never taught this stuff. And so when they actually look at the unit cost in this tool, some of them will say, that's not what this costs. Well, that's how much it costs, the incremental cost of you ordering it. Mm-hmm. So think about it that way.
That's right.
Because otherwise, we still paid for the machine. We're still paying for the people who are sitting there idling, right? And so that's important. But we do give them that. And it sort of hits home that thing that we all were taught in residency and medical school, that if I was taught in a very colorful way, this approach of ordering a test, a lab, you know, a study, is like picking your nose in public. You better have a plan for what you find, right? And if the plan that you have is, I'm just curious, I don't want to do anything differently with what I've got on my finger, you probably shouldn't do it, right? If you have a plan, though, with this data that you're going to use, then maybe you should, right? And again, that to me is how we sort of de-stress this situation is. I'm not trying to tell you what you should do. I'm just trying to give you access to information that will help hone your practice, especially when you're comparing against evidence base.
Yeah. I mean, the other way that I think about that is, as physicians, you know, when we're trained and we're learning what are the best diagnostic tests, what are the best medications to prescribe to patients, you know, beta blockers, or ACE inhibitors, or whatever class of medications, antibiotics we're going to be using to treat whatever condition we're treating, we don't always know the cost.
Yeah.
And boy, if I knew that a particular beta blocker that a certain cardiologist loved to use costs $200 a dose, and it's going to be dosed four times a day,
yeah,
and there's the alternative, metoprolol, that costs 50 cents,
yeah,
like that's going to make me think about that. And in certain patients that might be appropriate to utilize that more expensive option on that particular patient. But I don't want to be using that on every patient, right? Because that's just what I got comfortable with clicking in my order set. And so that's where I think that cost transparency brings so much value, because all of a sudden it starts changing the way that you're thinking about your orders, because you're being more cognitive of the cost side of the equation.
Yeah. The other part of that is sometimes that's a moving target. Like when I went to medical school and residency, Keppra was expensive. It's not anymore, right? And so
Zofran. We've actually seen it. Sure. Some organizations, Zofran is cheaper than Phenergan, and everybody had been using Phenergan for so long because they thought, you know, traditionally that was the generic, and it turned out that, you know, the Zofran costs less.
Right. And so I think access to that data in more real time makes, it breaks down those sort of folklorish kind of things, right? Because, you know, I'd have a patient come in and they're like, doc, you know, the care manager or case manager would come to me and say, they're not going to be able to afford this medication. And I'm like, well, how much does it cost? I'm like, I have no idea. And I don't want to put them on phenobarb or seizures because this isn't 1958. And I like livers, and so do patients. So, you know, Keppra it is, renally dosed, I'm sorry. And they're like, well, there's alternatives. So to your point, I think it helps inform decision-making in real time.
From previous conversations, you shared with me that you guys have made a ton of improvements in, you know, over the last 5, 6, 7 years in your quality and safety program at Riverside. What are some of the initiatives that you did? What are some of the key pieces of that program that you think have been really successful?
I got to say, it's obviously, you know, people will say, oh, it's a team effort, it's a team effort. There's no way that you can go and make the improvements that we have made without a team that is dedicated to doing it. So I want to make sure I say that in all earnestness. Terry Sievers, our quality director, trained at Mass Brigham and just brought a wealth of information down to us. But I think one of the things, and again, this speaks to my HRO brain, my high reliability organization brain, is you cannot rely solely on one thing, right? in particular, while education, I will say this till I'm dead, education is the silver bullet for almost anything, except for high reliability organizations, right? It is a necessary component, but it is not the whole shooting match. In other words, if you're relying solely on education, for example, we have a unit in our hospital that has not had a catheter-associated urinary tract infection in 10 years plus. Not one, right? Wow. Pretty impressive. They are clearly educated, right? And in fact, when a nurse onboards on that unit, that is one of the first things they hear. The bigger question is, how do you set up the surveillance? How do you set up the processes? And how do you set up the checks and the balances that you need to make that happen? Because in a high reliability organization, people will mess up. You know, this normal accident theory that came about in the late 70s saying, hey, you know, really complex system, accidents are going to happen. And HRO folks, mostly at Berkeley, would say, all right, well, that's fair, but how do we mitigate the effect of that? Because otherwise, we're just saying, all right, well, you check in a hospital and, you know, if you look at...
Bad stuff's going to happen.
Yeah, 250,000 deaths per year, depending on what methodology you use, and that's completely unacceptable, right? That would be like, I think what was the study to Air is Human or whatever, where they're like, that's like 500 fully loaded 747s crashing every year. That's a problem, right? And you look at those industries and see how, aviation in particular, which again, I know I'm going to get stuff thrown at me by physicians because I hear it all the time. We're not aviation. Well, there's a reason that, unfortunately, recently, it's kind of broken down a little bit, but there was a reason that we didn't have a fatal accident in the United States for 13 plus years, because they know how to design a high reliability organization. With human beings, it's different. And so if I were to wave a magic wand, it would be to send everybody to school to learn how to design systems in a highly reliable way, because it's not a simple matter of doing a 100-day workout on, hey, how are we going to get better on PSI-4? It's more than that. It is that, but it's not just that.
Awesome. Well, we've gone almost the entire podcast, and we have not mentioned the word AI yet. But yeah. As my last question here, what are some of the ways that you've seen AI in the last few months kind of coming into your practice, and where do you see some of the value being created at Riverside with some AI tools?
It's hard to overstate the impact on physician retention that occurred when we adopted ambient AI in the clinics. And my primary care doctor is a Riverside doctor. He asked me the first day I went to my 50-year-old well visit, right? And said, do you mind if I use AI? I'm like, please do, because I imagine it's helpful for you. He goes, it's given me my life back. And I don't think that's unique, right? Like time and time again, I heard that. And so the problem, though, is... it gives people their life back. That's not the problem, but are they checking what is in the note, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's all by way of saying, I think AI is going to be super useful in a lot of contexts, in particular ambient and maybe even generative AI in certain cases, but we have to measure our adoption of it with a lot of restraint and governance. And so this is the new copied forward note, right? Where it's like, oh boy, I didn't say that. Now, I will say this. It is way better than it was the day it started, because it's that by its nature. It's learning, right? And you use Dragon or Nuance or any of these other products. They're pretty good too if you trained them. The good news is you don't have to really train this AI. It trains itself. But you still have to go back and check. And medical legally, you better go back and check, because you can get bit just as easily that way. Where I see something even more revolutionary in there is, and I know I alluded to this earlier, that Eric Wexler talked about this, is will that solution be able to help with that massively expensive friction in the middle, which is a very people-based, checklist-based ripe for AI type of process with appropriate adult supervision on both sides. Because I do think people are in fear of, oh my gosh, that's going to eliminate my job. I don't think it will. I think it'll make jobs easier. But if we can eliminate a lot of that waste in the middle, I think that's going to be the way out of this sort of crisis in the United States. It's not just in the acute care setting. It is writ large.
Yeah. And in a way, allow physicians to get back to the art of medicine,
yes,
which is walking in a room and having a conversation with the patient and learning about, you know, what's challenging them.
And it's sort of anecdotal, but physicians will have more trouble doing eye contact again because with their patients, because they're not staring at a computer screen. They have to actually look at their patients. And it always reminded me of the joke from like a neurologist perspective is how can you tell an introverted neurologist from an extroverted neurologist? And it's the extroverted neurologist looks at your shoes when he's talking to you or she's talking to you. And so it's like, oh gosh, you know, I try to break that mold, but sometimes that's hard.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for coming on with us today. Appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, no problem.